Jagd und Hund, Day 4. My today's guest is Chris Norkia from Bukhara Hunting Safaris, or Bukhara. It's not only about hunting what you do, so please explain what Bukhara does.
Right. Max, thanks for this opportunity. So Bukhara is a global company with emphasis on tourism.
Yes.
Mainly. We've got 74 properties in about 5 countries. We also have a nautical department, about 19 slow yachts, 1 mega yacht. So Bukhara Global is ultimately geared and mindset towards tourism.
Mm-hmm.
I'm more involved in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
I lead up Africa and our properties that we own there. These properties are predominantly leisure and then conservation, wildlife reserves.
Okay.
Where we do hunting.
Okay. Sorry for the introduction. It's not only hunting.
But
I mean, we're here on the one of the probably biggest hunting exhibition in Europe. So I think for us should be hunting the main topic talk about it.
Yes.
But I think that hunting and leisure, or like photo tourism and all of those things, they're not separated, and they're like a part of each other, I think, because most of the people see it very critically, but I think that it's like that it belongs together most of the time, because ultimately the money that is gained, probably in your reserve as well, is going back into conservation. That is the money where you be able to actually do what you do. Is that right?
100%. I think people make the mistake on the other side of the fence, where they put a lot of pressure on utilization, maybe hunting, maybe agriculture of our, you know, of wildlife and habitat. And at the end of the day, on our side of the fence, you know, everybody gets along and happy and understand the whole utilization project, etc. But you make a very valid point, because the revenue that gets generated from hunting and utilization goes directly, firstly, back into habitat preservation, hunting, and the cause at the end of the day.
So would you say that hunting is conservation and one of the biggest factors of conservation?
I wouldn't say the biggest. That's a pretty big word to use.
Yes.
No pun intended. But I would rather use the word vital.
Okay.
It's a vital pivotal point in conservation. At the end of the day, and I have this discussion with many people, is we should change our mindset from we are conserving wildlife, we are rather conserving habitat. So if we don't utilize this habitat, if we don't utilize these spaces, millions and millions and millions of hectares in Africa and around the world, it will become pure either agricultural, you know, assets, or buildings, or condos, or you name it. And that is, at the end of the day, what we are trying to preserve.
And I think that is the opportunity that everyone has that has land or owns land, to actually do what they want to do it, but in a manner where generations afterwards have also the chance to use the land in the conservative way.
100%. So the great and beautiful term that I like to use is sustainable utilization. So you can use it as long as it's sustainable. And that is what we do.
Tell us what you do in Africa.
Right. So I used to hunt quite a lot, personally. Mm-hmm. Guide quite a lot all over Southern Africa. And, you know, I've unfortunately started spending more time behind a desk and directing things and so forth. But at the end of the day, the goal is the same. So I'm involved with a lot of conservation projects, managing the properties through managers that I have across South Africa. Ultimately, like I said, the goal is to utilize the properties, get clients in, tell our story, get the right people there, and make use of what we have.
Sounds very interesting.
Yeah.
No, it's like you always hear like the stories of like people in Germany, no, we shouldn't, who are not involved in the hunting industry, no, you shouldn't do hunting, or you shouldn't do this and that. We said that we don't want to talk of politics, but it's like maybe like a short thing that we can say is that what do you think about the involvement of other countries in your, like, deciding for your country what should be allowed and what should not, and what should not be allowed, maybe also in terms of like trophy import, trophy export, yeah. and how the country actually lives off that.
Yeah, this could get very heated, but let's not use names. At the end of the day, first and foremost, I know that the country in question, number one, should be first be consulted as to what is the guidelines, what is the suggestions, where do we want to go, etc. Now, you get instances where the country itself is probably not very capable of managing these assets. So what would the next step be? Is you approach the private owners. In South Africa, and I presume in Namibia, most Southern African countries, the highest wildlife population in ownership belongs to private ownership and not in state ownership.
We had many of those people here, like Willy Pabst, who
yes.
was in Zimbabwe, who owns a super huge property,
yes.
and he's doing a lot of conservation.
Yeah.
So
the numbers speak for themselves. Now, as we sit here, I can tell you right now in South Africa, the wildlife numbers has never been this high. It's super, super, super cool. And it's mainly due to private ownership. So to come back to your question, 100%. As private owners, we should first be consulted. What do we think? What's the best way to do this? And we should take revenue out of the equation for a second and really concentrate on what is sustainable. And your answer would lie in there. No emotions, no revenue. What is the most sustainable way?
No, 100%. Like yeah. yesterday we had Isaac from the ministry in Botswana here.
Right.
And he talked briefly about the current president that he actually consulted with the population about the hunting.
Yeah.
And then they lifted the moratorium in Botswana after asking the population. So for me, it would be a major thing that we also do that of European countries to actually go to Africa and consult with the private owners and also with the ministries and with the government. If hunting is what is if hunting is really what we tell them, and I think if they would see that, a lot of opinions would change afterwards.
You mean from a European perspective?
Yes, yeah. yes, from a European
100%. And that's it. The world adds too much emotion to their opinion.
Yep.
And we have to take emotion out of it completely. And we have to base it on facts, on science, and what you see on the ground. Emotion does not go hand in hand with these big decisions. And we have to move away from that.
Let's talk about again about Bukhara and maybe some of the properties. Where are you guys located in Africa? And like, how does a hunt work with you? And why should people come to you?
Right. So we operate in the Eastern Cape. We operate in Limpopo recently, the Kalahari.
Mm-hmm.
Those are our main hunting areas. It's quite extensive areas. It's not small. So we like to use the phrase extensive management and extensive hunting. In terms of how we do things, it's pretty old school, really, really old school. We have a very small numbers of clients every year.
Mm-hmm.
And we base this purely on what can we hunt rather than what do our clients request from us. So it's a really quota-based system, almost, if you can put it that way, and what's sustainable. Lately, the last 2 years, we've done a lot of family-orientated visits. So we incorporate a lot of hunting, then we incorporate a bit of sightseeing and a bit of leisure, down in the coast where we have some really cool properties. So we're concentrating on the whole family rather than just the old school dad comes to hunt and mom.
No, I mean, that's for most people or for most clients probably you have, that's a major factor because usually they're not single and they have a family with them or they would like to do the hunting and like afterwards do some leisure and do some holidays or maybe like even do the hunting with the family. And I think that's also like a part most of the people don't talk about, but it's like what attracts in the end is like that you can bring your family and that you have a good time with them and still keep the memories of what you do there.
Exactly, it's all incorporating, and at the same time, if you involve more family, you're spreading the goodwill, so to speak, teaching young people how to hunt, teach them the right way how to hunt, which is important.
100%. No, I've myself been to South Africa and really liked it. Right. And I think it's always a good trip. And
great.
I have a question about the ethical hunting aspect. You said that you do things old school. What does that mean?
Right. So,
and maybe also, where has the hunt how was there a change in the hunting industry like in the last 10 years? Maybe also due to social media. Do you see a change in that or like?
Yeah. So ethical. It's also again is a very big word.
Yep.
My mentor wrote me a message in my diary one day when I was still an apprentice many years back. And it said there, do what you know is right.
Mm-hmm.
And that phrase to me goes hand in hand with being ethical.
100%.
If it feels wrong, then it's wrong. If it feels right, then it's right. And in terms of ethic, many people have a different view on ethics. What is ethical? What is not ethical? Etc. Etc. And I think what you need to say to yourself at the end of the day, if you feel that it's right, then it's fine. Continue with it.
Very well said.
So in terms of what are the key factors of being ethical, I think there are certain boxes that we have to tick. You know, how do we hunt? Do we offer the animal an opportunity to get away?
Mm-hmm.
Or are we sitting on the back of a car and shooting at 200 or 300 yards and giving the animal zero opportunity to get away? That's a very simple way of putting it. So I think we've come a long way, really, truly, in terms of ethical ways of doing it, purely because there's so much eyes on us in the world. And I think it's forced a lot of people to change the way they do things. So it's a good thing. It's a good thing that there's pressure. It helps us to do things the right way.
The interesting thing is that what you just said, that the change is going to the ethical hunting.
Yeah.
Although it has never been unethical, but there's a big change in how
it's a bigger movement.
Yeah, it's a bigger movement.
Yeah.
For example, in Namibia, they changed now the regulations from the NAFA to like age-regulated measurements.
Right.
That means that there's like a certain multiplier that you get when you shoot or harvest older animals.
Right.
And which means that it makes it more sense for the farm to actually harvest only the older animals, because for them it's more important, because in the end it gets more point and it's more interesting also for the client.
Right, okay. I wasn't aware of this actually.
Yeah.
I want to go and have a look at it. As you say, I mean, there's so many factors that involves ethics.
Yes.
Your ethics might be different than mine, but there's a blueprint
that
we all need to stick to.
Do you see that there was a change due to social media in the last years?
A change in terms of ethics or?
Yes, also.
I think massively. Again, like I said, there's huge pressure on us these days to do things the right way. But in the positive way, but also in the negative way. If you look at social media, how it's wrongly put emphasis on our industry.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you got to ask yourself then, a picture could be perceived completely in the wrong way, which then automatically perceives that person as being unethical. Somebody that put their foot on a giraffe while taking a picture. That's the bad part of the whole hunt. But what you don't see is, how was the hunt conducted? They might have spent 5 days hunting the giraffe, spending kilometers and kilometers walking, who knows? And it was ruined by one simple thing.
By 1 second.
1 second of putting your foot on the animal, and everybody perceives it as being this horrible, you know.
No, like I think it's a very important point that you just said, because it's like this 1 second, this one click that changes everything in the perception of the people actually reviewing what you just did.
Yeah.
And I think that there should be, I don't know, we have talked a lot about it, that there should be like a training course for a lot of people how to actually work with social media and how to perceive social media in the public, because it's not only that hunters see what we do, it's also the public that's not non-hunting, and there's always a different perception in things. There might be some people who like in the hunting industry what we do, and there's people in the hunting industry that don't like what we do, and the same thing goes out to the public. And I think it's always like a very important thing that we review our actions, how we do something, and then change accordingly so that everything looks at least good on the picture that we take, because that is what other people perceive.
100% correct. So you got to ask yourself, as an outfitter and as a business owner, as a hunter, first, what is the reason you want to use social media?
Yep.
Why would you like to take a picture and make it public for everybody to see, or a hunt, or your opinion? And I think that should be the start of it.
100%.
You've got to have the right reason to.
Yes.
And I believe if you have the right reason, then everything will fall in place. If you are there for the wrong reason, to get attention, to gain popularity, whatever, you're going to end up getting the wrong attention and giving the wrong message across.
What would you say to the hunters coming to the exhibition here to actually like choose the right? I mean, you're an outfitter now, but yeah. How do you choose the right outfitter? What would you not? Of course, you can say come to us, but like
yeah.
I think it's an important question, because it also concludes to the ethics part. How do you choose the right outfitter?
Yes. So let me say the following: everybody started somewhere.
Yeah.
So the question is, how do you, as a first timer here, where do you start?
Yep.
Okay, then you jump ahead and somebody that's been here for 10 years, right? And the key factor for me is engagement. And that's why these platforms are here. It's for clients to engage with either known outfitters or potential outfitters. And I think as a potential client, or speaking from a client's perspective, try and engage with an outfitter. Try and engage with somebody who offers safaris and trips. And you'll very quickly get a feel of who that person is and who that company is.
Yep.
Everybody has buffalo, everybody has kudus, everybody has impala, everybody here has it. So you got to ask yourself, what experience am I going to get, and is there trust, and am I going to remember this trip for 2 or 3 or 5 or 10 years to come, or do I just want to go and kill an animal for the best price? So there will be your answer will lie in there immediately.
I think that's very right what you just said, and I think for me to choose an outfitter, it also makes it about the personal part. Do I actually like to talk to with this person?
Yeah.
Because you always have to keep in mind that you're going to spend the next 5, 10, 3 weeks with them, you know?
Exactly.
And
exactly.
Do you want to, can you work with this person?
Yeah.
And like, as I see you now, I would love to come to your farm and hunt with you. And I mean, there will be a lot of clients that when they see this, that will enjoy this.
Thanks for that. Look, it goes both ways.
Yeah.
As outfitters, we can decide as well.
Yes.
If we don't like the guy, we try, you know, go away from it. No, I'm joking.
So, oh, good.
Yeah.
Chris, thank you so much for coming to the podcast today. If you would like more information about Bokhara, we are here in Hall 7 of the Jagd und Hund 2024. And Chris will answer every question you have. You can just sit down and talk with him. He's a really nice guy. Come here.
Max, thanks.
Thank you.